Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. It was one of the deadliest pandemics in human history. 100 years ago, the Spanish flu was starting to spread across the world. It would go on to infect 500 million people and it would kill between 50 and 100 million people. Where did that flu come from? What made it so devastating? And what lessons can we learn from the 1918 pandemic for when the next pandemic arrives? Health Report producer James Bullen has been investigating and made this feature marking 100 years since the Spanish influenza pandemic.
We talk about it as the Spanish flu, so people might logically think that it originated in Spain, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
That's Dr. Kirsty Short, an influenza virologist at the University of Queensland.
Instead, probably the reason it was called the Spanish flu is because as a neutral country during World War I, Spain didn't really practice censorship of the press, so cases of flu were widely reported in the Spanish press. Now, in contrast, countries that were at war, such as Germany and Britain, they didn't really want to be talking about an influenza pandemic that was affecting their troops, because not only would it lower morale, but it could also make them seem more vulnerable to the enemy. So that's probably why it's called Spanish flu, and that's a bit of a misnomer.
This flu is tricky, and not just through its name. Almost everything about the 1918 influenza pandemic is fought over, contested in the medical literature. Why it was so deadly, how it came to be transmitted in humans, and indeed, where in fact it originated.
So the sort of predominant theories are either that it originated in China, it originated in Kansas in the US, or it originated somewhere in France or England. Probably the best supported theory is that it originated in Kansas in the US, and that it was then spread around the world by US soldiers, obviously going to fight the war. So it was taken on these ships and it was spread around the world as the war spread.
So there's the question of where it came from. But the other scientific puzzle about this pandemic is how it arose in the first place. And that's related to the key differences between a pandemic flu and a seasonal flu.
Every year we have seasonal outbreaks of the flu, and they can be bad. You know, last year in 2017, Australia had a particularly bad season, but it's not a pandemic. And the reason for this is because a flu pandemic occurs when a new flu virus enters the population and we have no pre-existing immunity to it. So even though every year the virus itself, it changes subtly, such that we need to update our vaccines and such that we can get the flu in 2016, we can get it again in 2017, it's not a dramatic change in the virus. When we have a flu pandemic, it's a dramatic change in the type of flu virus that we're getting. That's what's happened in previous pandemics. So in 1918, it was a big change in the type of flu that was infecting us. Again in 57 and again in 68 and again in 2009. So think of seasonal flu as something that changes slowly over time, so it's called a drift process. And when you have a pandemic flu, it's a rapid change, so it's called a shift process.
There are a few things that can prompt that dramatic change in the virus. Sometimes it's when a flu virus circulating in animals infects a human, starting the spread of a new virus. But those flus aren't always well adapted to humans. They might transmit well, but cause little actual harm. Or they might be exceptionally deadly, but with limited transmissibility. The other possibility is that it's a combination of flu genes from bird flu and human flu, or pig flu and human flu, or some combination of all three. That's called reassortment, when one virus host is infected with multiple strains of flu. The genes that make up each separate strain can mix and match into something new and potentially more potent.
This is certainly something that's happened in the other influenza pandemics of the last 100 years. So, for example, the 2009 pandemic was a virus that had taken some genes from avian flu, some genes from swine flu, and some genes from human flu. It really remains controversial as to whether this was the case in 1918. Other people argue that this may have been directly infection of humans by, say, an avian flu virus, and that it hadn't undergone this sort of mix and match process with its genes. There's some evidence to suggest that, but again, the sequence doesn't seem to look like any avian virus that we know. So it may be possible that this virus jumped into the human population from an unknown animal source and that we just haven't identified the animal source that it came from. We're still unclear, and this still remains one of the biggest mysteries of the 1918 pandemic.
That all ties into the China origin theory Dr. Short mentioned earlier, that thousands of Chinese labourers mobilised to work on the French and British front lines of World War I. It's possible this was responsible for the beginnings of the Spanish flu spread. And this makes sense from a modern perspective, in that we know many new flu strains come out of China or other parts of Asia. It's partly because in those countries, many people are in closer proximity to pigs and birds through things like live poultry markets. But when you look at other data from 1918, the theory that the virus originated in China doesn't quite add up.
The evidence that argues against China being a source or Asia being a source of the 1918 flu pandemic has come at least in part from some epidemiological studies showing that Chinese troops who were sent to World War I to fight didn't come down with the virus at any earlier rate or any increased rate than, say, troops from Europe. So you would think that if the virus originated in southern China in particular, that you would see that these troops were the first to be affected, and that doesn't seem to be the case.
There's something else that was strange about this flu. The groups of people it harmed were the opposite of what you might expect.
Normally what happens in seasonal flu is when you look and you plot the mortality of the virus and you compare it to age, you get this nice U-shaped curve where you get very high mortality in the very young and very high mortality in the very old. What happened in 1918 and to a certain extent other pandemics is that you get this W-shaped curve. So you have high mortality in the very, very old, but then all of a sudden you get this peak mortality in what's called young adults.
The prevailing theory as to why that occurred is that the 1918 strain of flu provoked an inflammatory response far worse than what was typical of a flu virus.
What seems to happen is that the virus can turn on the inflammatory response in the lung and it doesn't get turned off. So that means that your inflammatory response, you know, this is a pretty potent response that you've evolved to have to protect you against disease. It actually starts damaging the lung tissue. And as soon as your lung tissue gets damaged, it's very hard to breathe. So the theory is that these young adults are in their immunological prime. And so because their immune response is so good, this sort of negative or immunopathology response is actually really pronounced in this age group, and that might have contributed to the increased disease severity.
Medical historians are still arguing over what made it more deadly, the response the virus provoked, or the fact that it struck during a world war.
Firstly, obviously, movement. That's a big part, and that plays a big part in the spread of the pandemic. It's also about living conditions. You have soldiers who are living in barracks in close proximity. So that's not only a perfect breeding ground for spreading influenza, but it's also a perfect breeding ground for spreading secondary bacterial infections, which were actually the predominant cause of deaths during the 1918 pandemic. You know, the other thing to consider is that in a war, people probably aren't at the healthiest. You know, there's limited food available for both soldiers and civilians, so that can only serve to make any sort of infectious disease worse.
At the time, they didn't even know what this illness was. They knew it was deadly and spreading, but the influenza virus wasn't even discovered until the 1930s. That made fighting it exceptionally difficult, though there were some successes, including in Australia.
Maritime quarantine proved to be effective for some Pacific Island nations, and it actually helped protect Australia to a certain extent in that it actually delayed us getting the first case of the 1918 influenza. Other techniques that seemed to be useful were things like nursing. So in areas where you had supply of nurses, people typically did better than in areas such as mining communities where there weren't many women. As you know, if you've ever had the flu, day-to-day tasks become very difficult for you and you need somebody looking after you, providing you with liquids, trying to keep your temperature down, things like that. There's some evidence to suggest that some traditional remedies actually worked quite well. So some Japanese remedies, again, emphasising taking in fluids, emphasising things like cleaning hands. So there were approaches available, but it would have been very difficult to have a comprehensive strategy when one doesn't really know about what the agent is that's causing disease.
In roughly a year, tens of millions of people had died. But by 1919, new cases were rapidly declining. The pandemic was over. But the Spanish flu was to live again.
In the beginning, he was using a material that came from a collection that comes from the Army of the United States, based on a program that started President Lincoln.
That's Adolfo Garcia Sastre, a professor of microbiology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York. And he's talking about Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberger, then chairman of the Department of Molecular Pathology at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Maryland. Both men played a role in the reconstruction of the 1918 flu, but Jeffrey came first, and his work started with dead bodies.
What he started the program in which soldiers die for unknown disease, then samples are being taken and preserved for future generations to try to find out what was the disease that happened at this time. He was sequencing from these samples very little by little, because there were only small pieces left there of the genetic material. And then he found another source that contained more genetic material, though again it was also not in full form, just in pieces, which came from a grave, a mass grave in a little village in Alaska, in which in 1918, when the postman came with the mail, he came also with flu and infected the inhabitants of the village. And it happened to be that in very remote areas, the flu was even worse than in other areas. And that was probably because in very remote areas, there was little pre-existing immunity against any influenza. So what happened in this village is that all the adults die. And when the army heard about it, they sent out soldiers to bury the adults in a mass grave. And that happened to be that they buried under the permafrost line. So all the bodies were frozen since then. And obviously they were not completely preserved, but there was enough preservation to be able to take some samples for sequencing genetic material corresponding to the virus that was the cause of the death of these people.
Bit by bit, Dr. Taubenberger was sequencing from these samples the deadly blueprint of the 1918 flu. But it still wasn't a live virus. For that to come about, scientists needed to use a technique called reverse genetics, something Professor Garcia Sastre and his collaborators had been developing alongside Dr. Taubenberger's sequencing efforts.
That's what we call reverse genetics, which is the ability applied to viruses, the ability to recover viruses from plasmids. And plasmids are pieces of DNA that are being amplified in bacteria. They are not live, but contain the genetic material or a copy of the genetic material of the virus. Now, plasmids are DNA. They are very easy to grow in bacteria. If these plasmids can be converted into RNA by copying the DNA into RNA, one can express the genome of the virus inside a supporting cell that will support replication. Then, in general, one should be able to generate back the virus.
This wasn't straightforward or without controversy. The public, the media, and scientists criticised the team for bringing back a deadly virus. And it's a reasonable concern. Why did they have to make the living virus? Why couldn't they just study the individual genes?
The reason we did that is because we wanted to find out what was the reasons for the virulence of this virus. And without actually having the virus in hand, it's very difficult to know. There have been many theories why it was so deadly, the 1918 epidemic, including that there was a pre-existing condition in humans or a co-infection in humans with something else, that it was not only the flu virus that was causative of that. When the virus was reconstructed, it became clear that it was very highly pathogenic. But the pathogenicity, the virulence, was not encoded by a single gene. It was actually the combination of multiple genes, and it would have been very difficult to figure it out just one single gene. This also told us that because the virulence, it was a combination between multiple genes, the chances that this will happen again, they are very slim, because you need to have multiple virulence markers coming together in a virus that is very difficult to achieve that.
And what made the 1918 virus so virulent, so harmful, wasn't the same as what makes many other influenza viruses harmful.
When the sequence was obtained, you compare the sequence to some of the viruses, flu viruses, that they are highly virulent at the moment that we were doing these studies. Like, for example, the H5N1, so some of these highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses, these are characterized by a specific sequence in the hemagglutinin that are responsible for virulence. And this sequence was not in the 1918. So the 1918 reasons for virulence are different from the reasons of virulence of other viruses that they were studied before 1918. Now, knowing the ones that the virulence markers of 1918, we can better predict some of the virulence of the viruses that come. And one thing that we predicted as soon as the 2009 pandemic came, that was also an H1N1, that the virus will not be as virulent as 1918 because it lacked some of the virulence markers that 1918 had.
This is exactly why scientists would bring a deadly flu from 1918 back to life, to better understand it, so our efforts to fight future pandemics are better informed. Vital to these efforts is the work done by surveillance centres around the world that monitor influenza activity. These centres collect things like the number of patients visiting GPs with flu symptoms, infection clusters, hospitalisations. All that data is sent to one of five World Health Organisation collaborating centres for reference and research on influenza. Australia's home to one of them. It's in Melbourne, and it's led by Professor Kanta Subbarao.
At the WHO's collaborating centres, we actually look at epidemiological activity, which is disease activity. We have a number of different layers of surveillance that tell us how much illness there is in the community, how sick people are getting. So we have general practitioners reporting. We also have information from the states, and we have information from people that are admitted to hospital. So that gives us a measure of severity of disease and the amount of disease out there. But a very big part of what we do is also what we call virologic surveillance, where we study the virus and to see whether it has changed and whether the vaccine needs to be updated.
That updating is a decision to be made by the five WHO collaborating centres when they meet twice a year.
There are four influenza viruses that cause seasonal epidemics of influenza. There are two influenza A viruses that we call H1N1. And H3N2, and two lineages of influenza B viruses. We cannot predict ahead of time which of these four will predominate or whether we'll have a mixture of influenza A and B co-circulating. So the vaccine contains four strains. Essentially, we make an educated guess at picking a representative from each of these four to include in the vaccine. So what happens at these meetings is that we each collect all the information that we have from the previous 6 months, and we present those data and deliberate on each of these four strains and see what is circulating in the world, whether new variants, antigenic drift variants, have emerged. And then we also look to see whether blood collected from people that got the previous year's vaccine actually react well with these new variants. So we put all of that information together and make a recommendation. These recommendations are made twice a year, once in February for the Northern Hemisphere and once in September for the Southern Hemisphere.
But that's for seasonal influenza. What about pandemics like the 1918 flu? The Global Health Network is on the lookout for those too.
The labs that are doing diagnostic work will say we have a virus that we cannot subtype that doesn't look like what we had before. So they would send it on to one of the WHO collaborating centers to say, please characterize this virus. The other way is when an astute clinician might say there's something odd, there's a cluster of virus, there's a cluster of infections, perhaps in people with an animal exposure. So those are the ways that it's brought to attention.
Is it only when something like the 2009 influenza, the swine flu, comes around that those sort of notifications come in, or are you looking at those sorts of notifications more regularly than that?
So they happen infrequently, but we're always on the alert for them. There's certainly a lot more interaction now between the veterinary public health side and the human health side, because obviously we're looking for crossovers of animal influenza viruses into humans. Because we know that that's the likely source, we are in touch with colleagues who are looking at animal influenza surveillance. And so as part of our vaccine consultation meetings that happen twice a year to make recommendations for seasonal influenza, we also look at the data on infections at the animal-human interface. So we monitor those and also make sure that all of the collaborating centers have the tools necessary to identify if any such virus actually starts taking off and causing more of a cluster of infections.
Still, the question remains, could we have another pandemic on the scale of 1918?
Certainly the 1918 influenza pandemic, as you've said, was really the greatest infectious disease event of the last century. We've had three pandemics since then, 1957, 1968, and 2009. And in each instance, the severity of disease was less. So the total number of cases, the total number of deaths was lower. There have been a number of advances in clinical medicine, in the development of antiviral drugs, and so on. So I think that we are probably in a much better place. We've got much better intensive care management. We've got more support and antiviral drugs available. But could it happen? It probably could, because there are viruses like the H5N1 virus, for instance, or even the H7N9 virus that cause very severe disease in humans. The cases that are confirmed to be H5N1 or H7N9 infections have between a 40 to 60% case fatality rate. So it's very, very high case fatality. What is not happening with either of those viruses is the ability to spread efficiently from person to person. So there are three characteristics of a pandemic influenza virus. One is that it has to be novel so that most of the population is non-immune or susceptible, and it has to cause disease in humans. But the third criterion is that it actually has to spread efficiently and cause sustained chains of transmission and community-wide disease. So that's the third event, and that's what we watch for.
Research into influenza is evolving in multiple fields, and at the University of Melbourne, James McCaw, a professor of mathematical biology, is trying to model past flus to help protect us against a future pandemic.
If we just look at the raw data from, say, an epidemic like 1918 Spanish influenza or maybe 2009 swine flu that spread around the world, the data tells us what did happen, but it doesn't tell us why. And the mathematical models are used to ask questions of why. Why did it spread how it did? If we had done something slightly different in terms of our response, could we have made a difference? It's very much like how mathematics is used in other sciences, like physics, or how maths is used in economics, where you can look at the data, but you learn a lot more by applying models to that data because the models capture your beliefs and understanding of the system. So it lets us ask why something happened, not just observe what did actually happen.
And that might help us work out how to fight future flus. Take social distancing, which was one technique used to combat the 1918 flu. Governments closed down schools, movie theatres, told people to stay at home to stop them mixing and spreading the virus.
You and I, we're rational people. If we know that there are lots of people dying around us, we probably will mix less. We will choose to stay at home. We will choose to try and minimise our exposure to other people in the population. This helps prevent the spread of the disease, which is incredibly helpful. Of course, as that disease then slows down and stops spreading, maybe it's a few weeks, even a month or two later, we will relax. We will start to return to our normal lives. And what it looks like happened through the study of these past pandemics using the models is that the disease was still there and so it starts spreading again because the opportunity, the contact opportunities start appearing more often again. And so the disease comes back. And so you see the wave come, go, and then it comes back again because we start mixing. And so this oscillatory behavior naturally occurs. We can try and exploit this in our modern pandemic control plans by asking questions like, should we close schools? Should we close public mixing events? Should we not run the AFL grand final or something like that if the flu was spreading at that time? And the models would suggest, and past experience would suggest, that this would prevent some transmission. It may lead to reduced number of infections. But of course, the people who were susceptible are still susceptible. And so maybe it will just come back later.
What other lessons can we learn or things can we take forward for a possible future pandemic?
We need two things to be able to respond effectively. We need to think about what might happen in the future very carefully, which is where we develop models that are used as scenarios. We ask, if a disease with certain characteristics appeared on our doorstep, what would be the best response strategies? So we do all of that modelling. And then we also do this backwards-looking modelling where we say, we saw this event, what do we know about it? And then we have a third thing, which is rather new, which is forecasting, where we say the data that's coming into the health department each day from the hospitals or from the disease surveillance systems, what we're doing is developing models and statistical packages that read in that data and project it forward, and so make a prediction about how many people will get sick next week and the week after and the week after that. And what we've learnt by living through the 2009 pandemic is that we need all three of these ingredients, all have to come together. We need the scenario analysis modelling, the review of historical pandemics, and we need these forecasting capabilities so that we can bring it all together in real time, in a responsive fashion, so that we can make good decisions on the ground the next time something worrying appears.
But there won't be a flu report on your nightly news just yet.
Where we're up to is like weather forecasts from a very long time ago, I think. So we now have amazingly accurate weather forecasts, and they're on the news every day, and we use them to make decisions all the time. So we decide if we should wear a jumper or take an umbrella or go to the beach this day or go to the beach the next day. So we make decisions based on weather forecasts without even really thinking about it. And those models aren't good now. If you go think back 30 years ago, the models weren't so good. They were still useful, but you know, we had a 2 or 3 day forecast, and now we've got a 7 to 10 day forecast. Mathematical modelling and forecasting for influenza is like those old weather forecasts. We are starting to learn about how they work. Our forecasts are better than guessing, but there's a long way to go. But by building those early forecasts for influenza, we will then be able to make them better and better over years, I guess, is how long it will take. And eventually we're hoping to get to a stage where we have incredibly accurate influenza forecast systems that can really help our public health officers and government make good decisions on how to respond to these diseases.
Health Report producer James Bullen with that special feature on the 1918 flu, marking 100 years since the pandemic. I'm Norman Swan, and I'll be back next week with more on the Health Report. Do join me.